is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, October 28, 2022. And today will be better than yesterday, of course, because today is the start of the World Series. And we have a great show lined up for you. Taylor Schwenk is producing from the Schwenk Studios in the foothills of Connecticut. Sarah Abbott is working from the Miles Teller / Taylor Swift Tribute Studios somewhere near Bristol. And I'm Buster Olney in Houston. You guys fired up?
Oh, yeah. Been looking forward to this one. I mean, a couple days, no baseball. It's getting pretty dry around here. What about you, Sarah? You ready?
Big day. Big day. Huge day. I am so excited. I bought a Phillies hat. This is the day that the Lord has made.
Yeah. So, yeah. Lifetime Phillies fan getting a Phillies hat for the first time after jumping on the bandwagon and grabbing the steering wheel 2 weeks ago. Yes?
Yes, I am the conductor of the bandwagon. Thank you very much.
Very nice. Well, if you're looking for reasons why the Phillies might win, they're the underdogs in this World Series. We've got Paul Embiidkides, a research and Phillies fan who's convinced his team will find a way. We'll be talking with Steve Sparks, analyst on the Astros radio. AJ Hinch, the former Astros manager, will give us his take. We'll hear from Carl Ravitch, host of Baseball Tonight. And of course, we'll be hearing from Sarah Langs. Thursday was a day for workouts for both these teams in Minute Maid Park. They met with the media. Rob Thompson, the Phillies manager, talked about the approach of his team against this tremendous Astros pitching staff.
Hitters are hitters. I think, you know, we'll know their stuff. We know some of their tendencies, what they like to do, and we'll try to attack it as best we can. But I don't think, Kyle Schwarber is going to try and get base hits or bunt for base. You know, he's not going to really change all that much. So I think we just have to attack their weaknesses, whatever they are, and stay with our strengths and just put good at-bats together.
So coincidentally, the Phillies and the Astros finished up with each other near the end of the regular season. Here's Aaron Nola talking about that experience of pitching against Houston a month ago.
I guess we'll find out, but it's nice to be able to pitch on this mound for the first time, the last time we were here, just to kind of get a feel for it and know how it holds up. So I think that's an advantage to that part. But I mean, obviously, like you said, it's a different stage of when the last time we played here. It's a good team that we're playing against. So, and we are too. So I think we'll see tomorrow and we'll see this series.
He was asked about dealing with the bright lights of the World Series.
Yeah, it's a big stage and it's a World Series, but it's just another game when we step out on that field. And that's all I try to focus on is to make pitches when I need to and focus every single pitch. I can't control the results that happen. And the only thing I can control is my body on the mound and my emotions and, where that pitch is going. So, that's kind of how I keep my focus in line and my emotions in check.
Here's Astros manager Dusty Baker, of course, has never won a World Series as a manager.
That's why I'm here. You know, and that's why I'm glad that, you know, Jim Crane brought me back here. And also to a place that, most places I've been, I've had to sort of rebuild the team, but this team was sort of built already, and I had to, carry on and try to enhance what we already have here. And I'm just a ball player that's trying to play ball and trying to win. I love to win, and I've always said if I win one, I win two. So you got to win one first, and then we'll work on number two at that time.
Justin Verlander starts game one for the Astros. He also could be eligible for free agency this fall. And he was asked about the possibility this could be his last start as a member of the Astros at Minute Maid Park.
I don't know, man. I'm just kind of along for the ride right now. It's been a wonderful, year for me, my family at home and in the sport. I'm just trying to be present and part of it. I'm not really trying to focus too much on what's ahead.
He was asked about his preparation for this start, especially in light of how many days off the Astros have had.
I threw a couple bullpens. It's kind of one of that weird time frame where you're not going to, try to rush in an extra, simulated game or anything. So just threw a couple bullpens. This year I've had a couple times through the rotation where I had 8 days off. You know, so just kind of hope that all the repetitions throughout my entire life show up.
And there are some interesting numbers for Verlander in past World Series that we're going to be kicking around today. Taylor, what else you got?
Buster, right now, dear listener, you can check out the College Game Day podcast. We got the Week 9 pick show up with Reese Davis, Pete Thamel, and Bill Connolly. Also, all of our NBA shows, they are rocking and rolling right now. The Hoop Collective with Brian Windhorst, the CJ McCollum show featuring NBA star CJ McCollum, the VC show with Vince Carter, and the Low Post. You can find all of those shows I just mentioned wherever you're listening to this podcast right now.
Really? That's how we're opening Paul Hembekides' segment? The Phillies fan, the researcher at ESPN, the honcho on the show Get Up, in a segment that I have feared all week, ever since the Phillies clinched a spot in the World Series, Hembo. I have lived in fear of this conversation. I'm not sure how you're doing.
Yo, Adrian. Look, Buster. Look. You and I have been doing this a long time, and thus there are two things that you know about me, perhaps more than anything else. The first of which is, I am your classic researcher, rooted in the objective, right? Enslaved to the rigor of my research. That's obviously how you get to be what I am in this industry, right? Like, that's what I do. You also know that I am a crazy, bordering on obsessive, perhaps even obnoxious, some might say, all things Philadelphia sports fan. Baseball, of course, being my favorite sport. And so the last few weeks have catapulted me to new heights in terms of my obnoxiousness. So yes, your fear is well-founded, my friend. For the next 10, 12, 15 minutes, I'm going to ruin your day. And anyone who doesn't feel the same way, as I do at least, might feel the same way that you will. But look, I have to do it. I have to do it. I'm going to make a fact-based argument why the Phillies have a real chance to beat the Astros in the World Series. Just keep in mind that the person providing these facts also named his dog after Chase Utley.
All right, you believe that the Phillies have the best hitter and pitchers in this series. Who?
I do. Bryce Harper's the best hitter in this series, Buster. Right now, he is the toughest out in baseball. Take a look at this. With men on base in the postseason, Bryce Harper is 8-for-15 with 5 extra base hits and 17 total bases. Against fastballs in the postseason, he's 10-for-18 with 6 extra base hits and 22 total bases. If you see an open base with Bryce Harper up, especially with Nick Castellanos on deck, I could easily see Houston pitching around him or even putting him on. And I'll be really, really surprised if he sees the same helping of fastballs that he did in the previous series based upon those numbers. Phillies also happen to have the best pitcher in the world right now, and that's Zach Wheeler. Buster, he has faced 91 batters this postseason. He has only allowed 16 of them to reach base. That's 18%. In all 4 starts he's made, he's recorded at least 18 outs, allowed fewer than 5 hits, and walked 1 or fewer batters. In the whole history of baseball's postseason, which dates to 1903, there has been one instance, one streak, of a pitcher doing that 4 straight times, and it is Zach Wheeler right here, right now.
So let me ask you, how do you feel about how Rob Thompson lined up his rotation with games 1 and 2? Because I think it's the way to go with Wheeler. Because of the reasons you cited, I always feel like that you can really – people always look at the game 1 starters being the best guy. I think of the game 2 starters being the best guy because you're pitching games 2 and 6 on full rest.
I agreed with Rob Thompson's decision for 2 reasons. 1, you're going to have to use your bullpen way more than you'd like in this series. That's how it goes in a best of 7. And thus, I think having the opportunity to have every single one of your relievers fully ready, fully healthy, fully rested for game 1 with Aaron Nola pitching, your second best starter, makes a lot of sense. And secondly, Zach Wheeler has been absolutely ridiculous this season with extra rest. Ridiculous. So if you combine that 1 with 2, to me it just makes perfect sense. You get a well-rested bullpen for game 1. You get an extra-rested Wheeler for game 2. I think that provides the Phillies the best possible chance to win. I mean, Buster, on 6-plus days rest this year, a 1.57 ERA. On 5 days rest, a 2.57. And on 4 days rest, a 3.64. Those are pretty loud numbers. I think Rob Thompson got this thing right.
Speaking of the bullpens, I think the bullpen of the Phillies is the reason why they've gotten this far. We knew they could hit. We knew they had some good starting pitching. But I think the surprise in this October has been how effective their bullpen is. How do you see the battle of the bullpen shaping up?
I mean, what you just described, Buster, is a stunning development as someone who watched this bullpen melt down game after game this season. The Phillies had the number 23 bullpen during the regular season, a 4.25 ERA. It has been more than a run better in the postseason. It has gone from overnight a liability to an asset. And the craziest thing about all of this is that Rob Thompson has figured out a formula with the sort of three-headed monster of Sir Anthony Dominguez, Jose Alvarado, and Zach Eflin. Not just the guys he's elected to bring in high-leverage moments, but Wen has made a huge difference. Those three guys have faced 16 batters in high-leverage situations this postseason. Hitters are 2-for-16 with 8 strikeouts and no runs. They've allowed no runs in those situations. And while, look, I'll be the first to admit, the Astros had the best bullpen in baseball during the regular season. They've allowed 3 runs across 33 innings in the postseason. They have been ridiculous. Ridiculous. But consider this, Buster. Those pitchers, those relievers for the Houston Astros, they've thrown 518 postseason pitches. Every single one of those pitches has been thrown by a right-handed pitcher. And that, to me, could absolutely be a tiebreaker here if you're looking for reasons to favor the Phillies in this series. Lefties in the Phillies lineup this postseason own a 969 OPS with a platoon advantage. There are going to be high-leverage moments with Kyle Schwarber and Bryce Harper up at the plate facing a hard-throwing right-handed pitcher. And if I'm a fan of the Houston Astros, that does not sit well with me.
Real quick, a follow-up on Zach Eflin. It's interesting because his shift to the bullpen has been trumpeted, but when you look at the overall numbers, he hasn't exactly dominated. But I think what he does is that he limits damage. In other words, when Zach Eflin's out there, you're not thinking that he's going to give up a 6th spot. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you give him a 3-run lead, he might give back a run. He might give back 2 runs, but you're going to feel like you have a lead at the backside.
I feel the same way. I mean, the one time he's really gotten hit around this postseason was when he was pitching with a massive lead against the Braves. Matt Olson hit that homer to center, and that was it. Obviously, that has skewed the numbers a lot. What I like about Zach Eflin is that, A, he's able to, by and large, keep the ball out of the air, and so you're going to limit the kind of damage that you just talked to, which is obviously massive. But secondly, and you can just see this on his face, he's not the only Phillies pitcher for whom you can say this about, but he has a very, very low, easy heartbeat. Like, his mechanics are so straightforward. He delivers his pitches with so much conviction, and he's obviously not bothered by the moment or when men get on base. And that is a massive data point that we have to reference here. Like, this pitching staff has very much embodied the temperament of the manager. Now, obviously, throughout the regular season, that didn't show up much. But in these high-leverage moments in the postseason, it absolutely has. And for a pitcher with that Zach Eflin's experience as a starter, to be this trustworthy in the back end and massive moments in the postseason is a pretty rare thing. I think you've got to give it to the kid. He has most certainly exceeded my expectations for him.
All right, got 4 minutes, 3 topics to get to. Why do you give the Phillies lineup an edge?
There's 2 critical areas that have really keyed their success so far in the postseason. The first of which is their 2-strike approach. They've scored 24 runs in 2-strike counts across 11 games. The Astros have 10 of those across 7 games. Secondly, Buster, they have quick bats up and down this lineup. I harp on this every October when we talk. But against 97-plus right now, the Phillies own an 836 OPS in the postseason. The Astros a 664 OPS. We're going to see overpowering arm after overpowering arm come out of the bullpen. I give the advantage to the Phillies because they have proven series after series that they handle premium velocity. And lastly, the Phillies have jumped on starters early. In the first 4 innings of the postseason games, look at all the innings 1 through 4 in every game they played. They've got a plus 20 run differential, plus 20. No other team has a better than plus 5 run differential early in games. That has enabled Rob Thompson to line up his bullpen and obviously get the chance to chase the opposing starter. The Phillies have played downhill way more than I expected in the playoffs. They've been jumping on guys early. I think you're going to see them with a really aggressive approach against starters early in the game. That's worked for them so far.
You believe that the Phillies have the biggest advantage in baseball history in games 3, 4, and 5 in Philadelphia.
This is where I might lose, Buster, only, but I have to just lay out the facts, Buster. I just got to lay out the facts here, all right? The facts are these. In the history of Citizens Bank Park, dates to 2004, the Phillies are 21-9 at home in the postseason. They win 70% of their games. That, my friend, is the best record by any team in any home stadium in the history of the postseason. We're talking about 120 years of postseason history for that stat. They average 5.6 runs per game in front of their crazy fans at Citizens Bank Park. I was at game 3 of the division series, and Rhys Hoskins and Bryce Harper hit that home run and lit the city ablaze. I've never heard a sound that loud in my entire life. And I'll tell you what, the Astros are a really freaking good baseball team when they punch first, but they have demonstrated each of the last two times they've reached the World Series that they're not so good when they get punched in the face. And if there's anything about the fans in Philadelphia, they will punch you in the face.
I don't even know why I bother to ask this. Who are you picking to win in the World Series, Hembo?
So look, I'm not going to be obnoxious and pick the Phillies to win the series in a sweep. I'll go Phillies in five. Like, I'll give the Astros one game. The Astros will find a way to win one game, probably at home. Maybe they'll find a way to steal game one or two. But I'll tell you what, if the Phillies find a way to split in Houston, they're going to go back to the bank and win games three, four, and five in front of the greatest fans in the history of baseball. What say you?
I say that you are a great fan and, like, there's no chance. You know, that they, you know, to me, like, the easy low-hanging fruit, and Jeff Passan and I both grab for it, is Astros in six. That pitching staff is unbelievable. They're a better team, but you know what? It would be fun. If the Phillies won, it would be fun. That would be really cool. Before you go, I'm going to, like, knock you off your excited fan threshold and ask you about your daughters. How are they doing?
The daughters are doing great. Buster, my girls know no world in which my teams lose. The Eagles haven't lost yet this season. The Phillies are 3-0 in postseason series since they've – oh, you were asking about my daughters, not about my favorite teams. My mistake. Okay, so the girls are doing great. The girls are doing great. They're putting on the weight that they should be. They're crying a little bit less. They're sleeping a little bit more. They're making me exceedingly happy. After the Phillies won game five of the last series and clinched to go to the World Series, they're wearing their Phillies onesies. We got them matching Fanatics. We took a picture. Their father was almost crying. This is a great time. This is a great time to be Hembo. And look, we got two hungry Hembos in the house right now. Every few hours, it seems like they need to eat something. But look, we're as happy as can be. We're going to a wedding this weekend. So it's the first time they've gone anywhere and anyone will have seen them. It's going to be a wild ride. I just got to find a way to watch game one on the TV on Friday night because the wedding's on Friday. I'm very worried about it.
I'm not going to try to talk you down from your joy. All right, Hembo. Thanks for doing this. Have fun this weekend.
Ring the bell, baby.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes. The clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
AJ Hinch is the manager of the Detroit Tigers after 5 years of managing the Houston Astros, and he's a big baseball fan, which is why I have him back on the podcast as we get ready for the World Series. And AJ, you still live in the Houston area. You know, during the off season, travel back and forth between Houston and Detroit. What sort of response? What have you seen in Astros fans in recent days?
Yeah, it's been incredible. First off, the buzz in the city in Houston is real. The fans have been tremendous to me, my family, and really the Astros organization. I mean, I had some meetings near my house in Houston with a couple of Tigers people, and we go to breakfast, and it was Astros Central. So that, I mean, the response has always been good. Last night I flew in to spend the weekend with my family after a long week of work up in Detroit, and the fan was filled with Astros fans. So the buzz in the city is palpable, and you can tell that You know, while this fan base has been used to postseason baseball and even the World Series in you know, three times, I think in the last, whatever, 6 years or 7 years, but they love their Astros and the city will be rocking tonight.
Yeah. So when Astros fans recognize you, what sort of responses do you get?
You know, a lot of it is just like hello and pictures and, you know, a lot of thank yous for the stretch of time that I was here. And then a lot of questions about the players. I mean, Altuve, Bregman, you know, I get a lot of questions about Pena these days when I'm out and about, even though I didn't have him in the big leagues. And really just general buzz around the team. So I think that, you know, obviously it's been a very emotional stretch for Astros fans, and they've hung in there with the group and supported them through and through. And that environment in Minute Maid, like tonight, obviously the Phillies environment's going to be pretty rowdy when you get back to Philly, but, it's unlike a lot of ballparks around the league with the roof closed, fans packed. They're very, very well versed in postseason baseball after all these years, and they'll make it an advantage for the Astros.
That's one of the questions I was going to ask you is about the atmosphere in the two ballparks. Just from your perspective, if you can describe, you know, what's different, Houston and Philadelphia, when you're in the ballpark and you're feeling those fans.
Yeah, so Houston's louder. I mean, it's just flat out louder, and obviously both places are going to be pro their home team. I mean, it's a little rowdier, I think, in Philly. The fans in the Northeast, and they will get after the players quite a bit, I'm sure, and you know, kind of ride the emotions of the Philly players. I mean, they have so much home run power, and that kind of is the catalyst, I think, in Philly, and you can feel that. When the power comes, it's a ballpark. You can hit some homers in. Bryce Harper's smoking hot. Schwarber can hit the ball to the moon. If they get one of those, I can see Philly matching the volume of Minute Maid. But if not, it's impossible to match the volume in Minute Maid with the roof closed and all the fans that are packed in there and they're on top of you. It feels a lot more on top of you at Houston in the dugout as a visitor than it does in Philly, but. The rowdiness of Philly can get pretty good there too.
So give me a key factor in the series, because we talked about, I mean, look, the Astros pitching is absurd, right? Absurdly good. I mean, it, you know, the numbers, when you look at them, it's like, as our friend Sarah Langs described the other day, it's like peak Pedro Martinez, peak Jacob deGrom in terms of what they've done overall as a staff. And on the other hand, you have this team that's riding a ton of momentum, a ton of emotion in the Phillies lineup. Their bullpen has outperformed expectations. You know, for you, what's a key factor in this matchup?
I think it's going to be the ability for the Phillies to hit the ball out of the ballpark. You know, Houston is very tough to match up with. They have an answer for everything. They've got guys in the bullpen like Stanek and Urquidy who haven't even gotten a ton of action. Urquidy hasn't even pitched yet. So the depth of the pitching, where depending on what the game is, the score, they won't have to use the same guys all the time. So they'll get to match up differently with the different hitters in Philly. But if the Phillies guys, Harper and Hoskins and Baum and Schwarber, if they can hit the ball out of the ballpark, that's like a punch to a heavyweight fighter that is tough to come back from. If the Astros pitching neutralizes the power in the Phillies lineup, you know, Realmuto as well, like that to me is going to be hard for Philly to match. It's hard to get three hits in a row to score against the Astros. You need a big punch. The Phillies have enough of that, and their quick strike offense is going to have to be key for them to keep themselves in games with the Astros.
What's your read on Jose Altuve, who I know from talking with you through the years about him, he's one of your favorite people in terms of being around on a daily basis, just because of as accomplished as he is, the insecurities that are in play there, the great insecurities.
Yeah, I mean, he gets very aggressive whenever he doesn't get a lot of hits. He's so used to 200 hits a year. He's used to leading the team in hitting. He's used to being a catalyst, whether it be the top of the lineup or second or third. He's hit all over the top four of the lineup, certainly since I was there and then through Dusty's years. And he gets pretty emotional when he doesn't get hits. He expects to get hits, and he swings outside the strike zone. The more gap there is between hit to hit, when he gets momentum and he gets built up and he feel, you know, he gets one, he's going to get three. Like, he's a very momentum built hitter, and that comes and goes with the, with control in the strike zone. But he's going to be just fine. I know he's had a tough stretch in the postseason, and he got into swing mode a little bit in the last two series. But he's like one hit away from getting 10 hits in a series. Like, it's not going to phase him, the big stage or sort of the volatile environment in Philadelphia, facing some new pitchers that he hasn't seen a ton, which is always difficult when you get to the World Series and teams you haven't played a ton in the last couple of years. But you know, even though the numbers are always pro pitcher against hitters, you kind of always think Altuve is going to get a hit every time he's in the box.
So I remember hearing in 2021, late in the year, and this was probably like in mid-August, that Alex Bregman was going to need surgery on his injured wrist, hand, at the end of the year. And we got into the postseason, and he was struggling. You know, day after day after day, right, he was having a hard time, and we were breaking down his swing and all that. And he never mentioned the injury, ever. Like, it wasn't until after the year was over, when he actually had the surgery, that I think the media large learned about that. He obviously is in a better place physically this time around. What's your read on him right now?
Yeah, first of all, you can say that about a lot of players in Houston, that they're probably in a good place physically because they just haven't played the volume of games that most of the playoff teams do because they haven't lost. I mean, obviously the two games in one in Seattle kind of counts as an extra game, but generally these guys should all be physically good heading into the World Series. The one thing that I see about Bregman is when he's healthy, he's never going to make an excuse. He's never going to tell you he's hurt, whether it's his legs, his lower half, his upper half. Like, he's sort of always nicked up because of the way that he plays. He is so elite at controlling the strike zone and getting a good pitch to hit in big moments. You know, I remember hearing a little bit of the buzz about the pitching around Yordan Alvarez and getting to Bregman, or however the batting order is going to be. Like, I'm not sure you want Alex Bregman up to bat if you're an opponent, you know, in a big spot, because he's going to get a good pitch to hit and he's going to put the ball in play pretty hard. Whether it's a rifle ball to right field, I mean, he's got sort of shorter arms, can get to the ball inside and pull it to the Crawford box. But the most important thing that he does in the big moments during the World Series, during the playoff stretch, is he gets a good pitch to hit. Probably as good as anybody on that team.
Justin Verlander starts today. He's likely to win his third Cy Young Award this offseason after having a 1.75 ERA. He's a future Hall of Famer. To me, he should be unanimous selection when his name appears on the ballot. In the World Series, he still doesn't have a win. Seven starts, a 5.68 ERA. When I, have seen him pitch in the postseason, he reminded me a lot of Roger Clemens, who I covered, in that I felt like that Roger, it was such a perfectionist that he tended to put a lot of pressure on himself. What's your read on Justin going into this World Series?
Yeah, I mean, they're another probably beneficiary of them winning so many games is there hasn't been an extra start for him. This is going to be the most fresh he's been going into a World Series. Both in 17 and 19, we leaned on him heavy. ALCSs, where he's going 120, 125 pitches, and had an incredible run of success in the ALCS, and has run into the homer ball a little bit in the World Series, at least the time that I've been around him. He is a perfectionist. He doesn't put too much pressure on himself. His bar is high because he's Justin Verlander. Like, I think he takes an April start just as seriously as he takes an October start, but I think the margin for error is just so much smaller for guys that, when they get to the World Series and one bad pitch or one bad sequence or the big three-run homer, it's bitten them a little bit. But, again, walking out on the mound at Minute Maid, you want Justin Verlander there. He's going to post. He's going to have some high-end velo today. The slider will be obviously very key. And he's unflappable. Like, he's not a nervous guy as much as he is an intense guy during any given game. So I think he'll bounce back from he doesn't really carry the burden of the extra World Series stuff. He doesn't say a ton about it, but he'll post well.
Give me the name of someone who, whether it's the Phillies or whether it's the Astros, that you're excited to see have this opportunity. Because people ask me all the time who I root for. I said, I don't really root for a team. I just root for good stuff to happen to good people. For you, just watching someone who fills that category.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously I could go down a laundry list of guys. And it's always easy to go to the Houston guys. And, you know, obviously I'm super happy for Jose Altuve to get back on his stage yet again and continue to showcase that he's one of the best players in the game. It's been a very difficult stretch in his career, you know, in and around him. But, you know, I love that JT Realmuto gets an opportunity. He's a Midwest City, Oklahoma boy. He went to a rival high school, went to school with my nephew. His family are friends with my family in Oklahoma. I don't know him tremendously well. I've met him at an all-star game and crossing paths, and, you know, Oklahoma boys kind of stick together. So seeing him on this stage after his career is sort of winded through, he picked the right place to go to, and he's going to be a center figure in this series, given the fact that I doubt Bryce Harper sees a lot of good pitches, and you're going to need somebody else to step up in order to keep up with the Astros, and I'm rooting for JT to have a good series.
What's up with the Oklahoma catchers, AJ? You know, you got you, you've got JT, you got Johnny Bench.
So I'm not sure all of those are in the same category. Johnny's in like a category on his own. You know, JT has already surpassed me in terms of success. My catching career was just a precursor to going to manage for hopefully a long time. But we're pretty prideful about our catching group in Oklahoma.
Yep, no doubt about it. All right, AJ, thanks for doing this.
I appreciate it.
Steve Sparks is the analyst for Houston Astros Radio, working alongside Robert Ford. Sparksy, how you doing?
I'm doing great. You know, we're sitting at the precipice of another World Series, and it's not like it's old hat, but it feels very familiar for Astros fans, for Robert and myself. But this, nevertheless, just as exciting as it's ever been.
Now, coming into this World Series, you know the Astros are favored to win. I went with the low-hanging fruit myself. I picked Astros in six because of how incredible their pitching's been. You know, we had Sarah Langs on earlier in this week talking about the amazing numbers that they put up. You know, the opponent's batting average of 178, opponent's or ERA of 188, a strikeout per nine-inning rate of 11.1. You've seen a lot of great Astros pitching. How dominant is this group compared to previous groups in recent years?
1-13, by far the best. I mean, they've had some staffs where they had Morton and Garrett Cole and Verlander at the top and things of that nature. But 1-13, you know, now with the emergence of Brian Abreu, some of these guys in the bullpen, they've given up three runs in 33 innings so far this postseason. They're as dominant as I've seen it. And it kind of stemmed from 2015, Buster. If you remember, the Astros were 8 outs away from advancing against the Kansas City Royals that year, the year the Royals won the World Series. But they couldn't strike them out, and that was a big problem. Is there was a lot of chance that the Astros didn't want to take, and to take away chance because the Royals kept putting in play and finding some holes that the Astros went out and were determined to get guys in the bullpen who could strike you out.
So all week, since the Yankees were eliminated, as you know, the conversation in New York has been, you know, should you fire Aaron Boone? Should you fire Brian Cashman? You know, what major changes do you make because the Yankees failed? And I've been laughing at that. I'm like, did anybody actually watch the series? Because I didn't think these two teams were close. I thought the Astros were that much better than anybody else in the American League. What was your view?
At this point in time, I agree. You know, once the series got underway, I thought it looked pretty apparent, you know, without Benintendi, without LeMahieu, and some of these guys that really put the ball in play. We're talking about the lack of strikeouts. It felt like the Yankees were at a disadvantage. The Astros do on the other side of the coin. They put the ball in play. I know there's a lot of good strikeout pitchers out there, but they don't leave the strike zone very often. You know, you will see a lot of pitches just an inch or two off the plate that the Astros are able to spit on, even with two strikes. And that's what makes them very, you know, kind of difficult to manage over the course of a game and a series.
How the heck did the Astros put together a staff like this, this deep in your eyes?
In my eyes, I mean, you guys have heard the story about Oz Ocampo and his directive about 6 or 7 years ago to find some of these pitchers that are a little older that may have slipped through the cracks. And whether it's luck or great scouting or a great plan, the Astros have four guys right now with Cristian Javier, Jose Urquidy, Framber Valdez, and Luis Garcia, who don't cost very much and are in their rotation. And because of Verlander coming back from 2 years of inactivity, he was able to, for two thirds of the season, to roll with the 6-man rotation. A lot of times pitching like a college pitcher, pitching about once a week. And that kept him as fresh as possible. He had a phenomenal year, and everybody did. All the starters started to go a little deeper. You've got to have 6 good ones to be able to pull this off. And the Astros did. And because of the length of the guys in the starting rotation right now, you're looking at a very fresh bullpen too, especially with all these off days so far this postseason. But Presley's pitching as well as he ever has. Hector Neris was obviously a great pickup. James Splitt got him from Philly in the offseason for a couple of years. But Montero and Abreu in particular, I don't think anybody, including the Astros, saw them to be as dominant as they are this year.
All right. Did you know Azucena just he's in the news. He just took a job to be the assistant general manager of the Miami Marlins. This is just in the last 24 hours. So as we go into game one, the Astros are going to face Aaron Nola. And what I got back from rival evaluators, folks who are watching this from other teams, is, Aaron Nola is a terrific pitcher. We know that his number one weapon is that great curveball that he has. But I got back from people like, nobody hits spin better than the Astros. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I agree. But, I think it was Larry Boa talking about Nolan Ryan. Like, you might be a good curveball hitter, but nobody hits a good curveball. So if he locates it well, nobody hits it. Nola, for me, he's one of my favorite pitchers to watch in baseball. I think he's phenomenal. But I've kept pretty good track on him this year. And when the wheels come off with Nola, for whatever reason, I don't know if it's defense or what's going on, but I've noticed just from periphery that they come off pretty quickly. So I think you got to be patient, and for the Astros to get to Wheeler or Nola, I think they've got to get them out of the ballgame at some point and go to plan B, because those two guys in particular are two of the best in baseball. But Nola, I'm a huge fan, being able to throw that two-seam to both sides of the plate, the mix of pitches, the mix of speeds and all that are a lot for anybody to tackle.
So you've experienced both crowds in Philadelphia, in Houston during the course of your career. How much do you think that that's going to be a factor in this series?
It's going to be a factor for Philadelphia, but not for the Astros, I believe, Buster. And you know as well as anybody is, and people talk about it a lot, they're as battle-tested at this point of any team I can ever imagine in baseball. I mean, they're the obvious villains for a reason, but they've felt and seen and heard anything that you can throw at them, at this point. Chicago White Sox last year, New York Yankees, Seattle. I mean, everybody's out for blood. Dodgers, it doesn't matter. But and if anything, it may take them to another level as far as their focus and concentration and their us against them mentality. I just don't think it's going to help Philadelphia as far as getting to the Astros and making them do things outside of their comfort zone. Now, can it elevate the Phillies to another level? Schwarber goes deep at an opportune time in the seventh inning. Yeah, there's no question it can help the home team.
What have you seen in Dusty Baker, during the course of this postseason run?
He's himself, and he talks about, as far as culture in a clubhouse, he says he tries to stay out of there as much as he can. He wants those guys to feel relaxed and feel like they can be themselves, not having to look over their shoulder and seeing the coaches and the manager listening to what they say. He wants that clubhouse to be theirs. It's why he is who he is. He's the most likable, maybe, manager I've ever been around. He's just so fun to be around, listen to, learn from. I love him. I would love to play for Dusty Baker, and there's a big reason why he's ninth all time in wins as far as managers go, and I think a lot of the players will tell you they'd love to win this for Dusty.
Where does Jose Altuve sit right now, you think, in terms of how comfortable he is at the plate?
Well, it's going to take a couple of good swings of the bat for him to get comfortable again. I think he's just really sensitive, Buster, and he gets off to a slow start. He hates to let his team down. He hates to let his teammates down, and I think he starts to chase once he gets off to a slow start or a bad start. And I've seen this during the course of seasons, throughout the years for the last 10 years, where he'll have these slumps, maybe not to this degree and not with the lights this bright. But when he comes out of them, I mean, a lot of times it's a 9-for-11 stretch that he roars out of these types of situations. So one of the best hitters we've seen, he's got a lifetime average of over 300 for a big reason. And he's got elite, you know, ball to bat skills that we haven't seen in a long time. So he gets off to a good start and he swings at that first pitch and connects. I think he'll be off to the races.
Yeah, Sparksy, I mentioned to you that I talked to AJ Hinch and he said that Altuve's one hit away from 10 hits.
That's it.
Yeah, the way that he described it.
It's funny. That's exactly the way AJ has seen it too. You know, we see it was as soon as he can calm down a little bit and not try to chase and leave the strike zone and keep his head a little more still and slow the game down, that there's nobody better about getting the barrel to the ball.
All right, sir. I'll see you in the broadcast booth in just a few hours.
All right, man. Looking forward to it. Y'all have a good call.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All aboard. It's the Rabbit Train with Carl Ravitch.
Carl Ravitch, play-by-play man on Sunday Night Baseball. And in this round with the World Series, he's going to be the host of Baseball Tonight, which means, Rabbit, you're doing about 50 shows a day, right? And 50 SportsCenter segments, right. You know, all kinds of rundown. But the cool thing is you just react. It's not like we sit around and have to plan for what you're going to talk about.
Yeah, no, this is a good one. And in fact, the train thing is great because I'm literally looking out my window at Minute Maid Park where the train actually goes on its tracks in left field. So I got a great view of, and I swear I just saw the ball Albert Pujols hit. It's rotating around Minute Maid Park here off of Brad Lidge. So I'm watching that too. Now this is great. You guys are all here. Kirkshin is here. This should be a, look, Buster, this should be a really – it's fascinating, and a lot of it may be dictated by games 1 and 2, which we'll get to. But, boy, this is Rocky and Creed or Rocky and Drago. This is Bad News Bears against the Polish team. It's got so many neat wrinkles to it that I'm really – I'm looking forward to this World Series.
Yeah, and before we get to that and your view on some of the key elements to look at in this matchup, I want to talk about David Stearns, who yesterday Yeah, the Brewers announced that he is stepping away as the head of baseball operations for the Brewers. Matt Arnold is ascending into that spot. And the quote from David Stearns is, "It not only requires total commitment in the present, it requires total commitment in the future. When I begin to hesitate about whether I could make that commitment, I knew it was really time to contemplate a change." And so he, according to the Brewers, shifts into an advisory role. What I tend to look at this, Carl, is David Stearns has been put into baseball purgatory because he has a signed contract with Mark Attanasio, the owner of the Brewers. We know about all the speculation that's out there about the Mets. We know that there's a lot of speculation that Astros owner Jim Crane, who had David Stearns working for him before, would be open to the idea of changing his general manager away from James Click. And I think this is a case where the owner of the Brewers doesn't want David Stearns, who signed this contract, to simply walk away and go start working for another organization. So they basically have agreed to disagree, and now Stearns is going to have to wait out his contract for the next year, which, I got to be honest, doesn't make much sense to me. Like, if I'm Mark Attanasio and I've got someone working for me that I know wants to work someplace else, heck, you know what? Just call another team and say, look, let's work out some sort of compensation. What good does it do anybody to have David Stearns in a penalty box? What's your read on this?
Yeah, I'm in line with you. And the unfortunate part for me is that you get to this particular point in this long relationship and successful relationship to the extent that Stearns and Atanasio, you know, worked together and had a team that was generally competitive for the years that he was there. And it's going to end this way. You know, kind of a real bad breakup, an unnecessary evil to this. And I think we've all been in places where in order to make a relationship work, both people need to be involved and want to make it work. It's quite clear. You know, the David Stearns is looked at what Bloom has done and where he started and where he ended up. Certainly where Friedman started, where he ended up. There's a desire to leave these middle market organizations for what is a greener, literally, pasture in a big market. And, you know, a couple of years ago, we heard that flirtation and he stayed. It's going to happen, and whether it's with the Mets, the Yankees, the Astros, whatever organization, David Stearns, to me, is not going to end up going to a place market size like Milwaukee. He's done that, and now it's time to see what he can do at the next level, and the flirtation from these big teams is out there. He knows it. So this idea that we're going to, as you said, and that's an apt description, hold him in contract purgatory serves nobody. Now, look, there is a contract, and I respect the hell out of that. So, yes, there should be a way that they can work this out, whether it is with compensation, however you define it, player, financial, et cetera, between one organization and another. But my God, baseball's got such a long history of exchanges, not only player for player, but front office, et cetera. So I agree. I hope that they can resolve this. It feels incredibly unfortunate for Stearns to be in this position, albeit you have a contract and you are in this position because of that contract. You hope that the two sides are able, if in fact some team wants to pay Stearns to come run their baseball ops, they're able to work it out, because it's going to be a bad year and a lost year. And that's not questioning the professionalism of David Stearns. It's obvious what's going on.
Yeah, and a lost opportunity, I think, for the Brewers in the end. We know that Steve Cohen, the owner of the Mets, asked for permission last year to talk to Stearns. Mm-hmm. He was turned down, mm-hmm. which is the right of Mark Atanasio to do that. From what I understand from talking with sources, Cohen's perspective now is, I'm not going to go down that road again. So, you know, if a phone call's or if there's going to be an exchange, you know, with the Brewers and the Mets or the Brewers with the Astros, I think it's Atanasio who's got to pick up the phone. And basically say to Steve Cohen, look, are you interested in this guy? Or to call Jim Crane and say, you know, is this someone you want to talk to? And why not, Carl? Like, I mean, first off, you get out of paying his salary, A, and B, maybe look, you get a B-minus prospect.
There, Buster. The man doesn't want to continue in that role. What other evidence do you need than the person coming to the table and saying, I can't commit to this. I don't want to do this anymore. You could double my pay. It's not a pay thing. He has fulfilled in his mind, you know, his obligation to the Brewers in the sense, like, I don't want to do this with this group anymore. It's been great. And if we can figure out a way to get out, great. If we can't, I'm going to honor it. I'll be here for the year. And he's a professional. He'll do what he can to improve it. But his heart's not in it. I mean, come on, you know, it's forget writing on the wall. This is a conversation. This is obvious. This is it's a difficult breakup when you're the person in this case, Atanasio, who is being told, I don't want to be involved here anymore. That sucks, you know, and you got a contract and you signed it and you committed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It stinks. It's really bad. Now your goal is to make the best deal possible. And hopefully that happens.
All right, we've talked to A.J. Hinch, we've talked to Paul Imbecides, we've talked to Steve Sparks and asked them for their keys in this series. In your eyes, what's the pivotal point in this World Series? What is this going to turn on?
Well, the urgency to me is obviously it's right here. It's tonight. It's Verlander's ability to utilize what he has utilized this year on his way to another Cy Young, which is get guys to chase, you know, his slider, his curveball. And I think run the risk of, because he makes a living with a high fastball, trying to get that past the likes of Schwarber, who's really good at hitting it, and Segura, who can turn around a fastball, and Real Muto. Look, the Phillies have one goal. That is ultimately the split here to me. And if they don't, I'm not sure the series comes back. I think that's the urgency of this series, is what happens with Verlander, given his track record in World Series. You know, 0-6, 5.68 ERA, home runs. He and Catfish Hunter have allowed, given up 9 home runs in World Series. A, it's a tribute to how many you've been in, but also your inability to eliminate that. And the Phillies have made a living with home runs. We've seen it in this postseason. So I think the urgency is right away. It's right out of Jump Street, and Nola is a damn good pitcher. I mean, Nola is fantastic, and he starts burying two-seamers. They're going to be challenged tonight, especially the lefties, and that's, you know, that's Yordan Alvarez, and that's a huge bat, and Tucker. So the urgency is game one, and I don't know that we say that all the time. I think that's part and parcel because the Phillies have two real great starters. In spite of Ranger Suarez's success, I think the Astros are a dynamic enough offense that you've got to be the ace or co-ace to beat them. You need those dudes. And then you can hand it off to, you know, Alvarado, and you can hand it off to Dominguez. They're filthy. They're great. But you only have four bullets to me. You know, you got those four starts, and you got those guys to follow them. You have no margin for error. The Astros do, and I think game one is huge. And Verlander's the X factor, because to me, Nola's reliable. Verlander, at least in the World Series, the resume doesn't suggest that. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, I'll repeat those numbers. 7 starts in the World Series, 0-6 with a 5.68 ERA. He told reporters yesterday that he feels like that he's had games where he's pitched better or pitched well enough to win, but he just hasn't done it. It's funny, you mentioned the home runs. You know, when I asked AJ about, you know, what's going to be pivotal, that was the first thing he mentioned. He said keeping the Phillies in the ballpark. And the way that he described, Carl, the impact of the home runs for the Phillies reminded me of when you're watching an NBA series and there's a thunderous dunk. And it's not only what you gain, you know, statistically out of that, the points, but also the impact on the dugout, on the fans, everybody. And AJ felt that. And that does seem like it's a big part of what the Phillies do, right? They feed off each other with that power.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I think it's a bit dismissive to suggest that's all they do. And look, obviously, we're going to remember Harper's homer. We're going to remember the intentional walk of Schwarber that led to Hoskins' big home run during this one. But I look at the Phillies a little differently. And I know, and look, in this ballpark, hell, literally where I'm sitting, somebody could get a hold of one and hit it through this window if there was no roof. I mean, that we're that close, and it's in the left field boxes are so short, you know. But how many at-bats did they come up with Gene Segura, 2 strikes? Let's get a ball through the hole in a quasi-shift, or if they're holding a runner on. Like, they're a little deeper than just a home run hitting team. And that's really what I find interesting. There are some mirror images to me offensively between these two teams. They obviously have guys that can bash the baseball, but they cause problems. You know, there's less to me perception-wise swing and miss, and I guess I always fall back on the dang Yankees, and I'm not sure that's even fair, but when we watched the AL playoffs and the Yankees were involved, there was, and you and I talked about it, kind of this plodding approach, waiting for the 3-run home run, waiting for Aaron Judge or Stanton to hit one over the wall. In these two teams' cases, that's a big aspect, but it's not the only aspect. And they're going to put the ball in play. And I think that's what makes this series so interesting. I think it's going to be exciting. I think there's a little old school feel to both of these teams, and that's refreshing. So yeah, the home run is a big deal, but there may be a bunch of home runs and they could nullify each other.
All right. Give me your pick and give me your MVP.
You know, to me, it wouldn't shock me if the Astros swept it. It also wouldn't shock me if it went six games. So all that being said, I'll take the Astros in five games, and Alex Bregman is the MVP. I think we're starting to see Alex Bregman. You know, we did a Sunday night game here in Houston the day that Vasquez got traded from the Red Sox, and I remember having a conversation with Alex. You know, and there were times it felt like he was searching a little bit this year, you know, and there was the a little paralysis by analysis or over analysis. And we just chatted, and I said, you know, we've been doing this a long time, and I've watched you play third base, and you're a dang vacuum, and you know, you're best. I see you back to your LSU days. You're best when you believe that. Like, you are Alex Bregman. You are amongst the best players in the game. Like, where is that bravado? Where's that guy? And I think that guy's back. So while there are a lot of candidates to win it, I think Bregman is, he's my pick to be the MVP.
All right, Ravi. I'll see you at the ballpark later.
Thanks, Buster.
0-0-9-6.
This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, reporter, producer for MLB.com. Sarah, are you doing okay today? How are you feeling? Especially after hearing Taylor's serenade as you were brought on Zoom. Have you recovered from that?
That was wonderful. I hope we're recording. I hope we can share that with the people, because that was fascinating. But yeah, I'm doing great. We have World Series Baseball tonight. What is better? Absolutely nothing.
No, we didn't need to record it, and I knew this as I asked that question, because I'm going to insist that Taylor come in and sing that same song that he just sang, which was made up as we went along. Taylor, just jump in.
Well, it's hard to replicate greatness, but let me give it a shot here. Sarah Langs coming in to talk about baseball today, World Series Friday. It's not the same one. You get a different one every time, Sarah.
Oh, my gosh. I love it. I love it. Great energy. For World Series Game 1, that is what we need right now.
All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number 3.
Number 3 is 39. So Justin Verlander is 39 years and 250 days old today. That makes him the fourth oldest pitcher to start Game 1 of the World Series, younger than only a 43-year-old Roger Clemens in 2005, 40-year-old David Wells in 2003, an early win in 1959, who was 39 years and 18 days older than Justin Verlander is right now. This is the 12th time in his career that he will start Game 1 of a postseason series, which ties John Lester for the most Game 1 starts in postseason history. And entering tonight, his team has won 7 of his 11 so far. Postseason series Game 1 starts, which is tied with CC Sabathia for the most.
Number 2.
Number 2 is 8. So the Phillies, as we know, snapped a 10-year postseason drought this year, and they didn't just snap the drought the way the Mariners did. They snapped the drought, and now they're playing in the World Series. So they are the 8th team in the wildcard era to reach the World Series in the season where they snapped a 10 or more year postseason drought. So there have been 7 previously in the wildcard era, only one, actually one at all, and it was the 2002 Angels against Dusty Baker's Giants.
Number 1.
Number 1 is 111. So we talked the other day about Dusty Baker, all of his experience, and what that would mean if he were to win the World Series. So on the opposite end, you have Rob Thompson, who has managed 111 regular season games in his career, obviously just since he took over for Joe Girardi this year. So first of all, that is the fewest games for any non-player manager to reach a World Series. And so, of course, it would be the fewest if he were to win. The fewest currently for any manager to win a World Series, career games managed at the time, is 156 by Bucky Harris in 1924 with the Senators. So it has been a very long time since we saw a manager this inexperienced win a World Series. And then on the other hand, we have a manager who, if he won, would be the most experienced to win it.
So I was asking AJ Hinch, Sarah, about, set aside, rooting for a team or thinking of, being happy that a particular team wins, someone who's playing in this World Series that he's excited for, excited for this opportunity. And he mentioned JT Realmuto because he has the same, background, Oklahoma catcher growing up that JT does. Tell me, for you, somebody who's in this World Series that you're kind of excited for, and if they were to get something, you'd be fired up to see him win.
I mean, it's hard not to say Jean Segura, who, of course, had that streak entering the postseason of the most games of any active player without making the postseason. He ends up with the Phillies. He says, what's going to happen here? And it does a few years later. He's just been so excited. I have that image in my mind of him jumping into the pile for their team photo after they won the pennant. If you go on Twitter, you see it, and he's kind of lying on his stomach because he almost missed the photo, so he had to jump in. And they feel like he really carries that, youthful exuberance. Of course, it's funny, he's not that old, but in baseball terms, he kind of is. He's been around a while, so I think it's him for me. But there's so many other players. I almost said Jeremy Pena, because he's been making the most of the stage he's gotten as a rookie, and it's so awesome that he gets to do that on the next stage now as well.
Yeah, I love earlier in the week when the Astros were making the flight the Phillies were making the flight from Philadelphia down to Houston. Jean Segura boarded the plane in a full uniform like he was a 10-year-old Little Leaguer, showing up at school wearing his Little League uniform. Now, he explained to reporters after he went straight from the workout to see his family to getting on the plane, so he didn't have a chance to change uniforms. But I thought it was perfect, given his enthusiasm level,
So. Oh, yeah. That was awesome. And I saw the explanation. But regardless, I feel like that's sort of what we expect, how we associate him with his love for the game. So it's perfect either way.
Speaking of love for the game, here's Eduardo Perez, our colleague at ESPN. This is what he has to say about you.
I think this is an easy one. What makes Sarah great? What makes Sarah great is her upbeat personality, her desire to always find what others can't find, and do it with a smile. I think, when you think you're asking her a question that there's no way she can find an answer for, she doesn't stop until she does. And even if she does get it for you and it's like not on time, it's the most apologetic, most sincere, most real person that one can imagine. I think it's Sarah. I smile. And it's not because of Sarah's condition. It's because who Sarah is since the first day I ever met her. I would tell her, okay, you're a vegetarian, but you got to eat. Whatever it takes to get Sarah from point A to point B, I've always said, I'll be there for her. And this is as genuine as she is with all of us.
Yeah, so earlier this year, we learned that Sarah Abbott is named for the song Sarah by Fleetwood Mac. Sarah, I don't know if you remember that, you heard that, but I'm curious, which song could you relate to more? Was it Sarah by Fleetwood Mac or Sarah Smile, I guess, by Hall & Oates? Like when that song played, which one could you relate to better?
I think it's Sarah Smile. I mean, I always think of that. That one is S-A-R-A, like Sarah Abbott. I have the H, but it's okay, it's not a Hall & Oates fault or anything like that. But I do always think of that song. And I think that would probably have to be it. And thank you so much, Eduardo, and again to you for all of these very kind words. I mean, I'm so honored to hear those. So thank you.
All right, Sarah. Well, I'll be in touch, and we have fun watching the game tonight.
Enjoy it. I can't wait.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, everyone. Bleacher Tweets for a Friday. And Bleacher Tweets are brought to you by Dr. Pepper. It ain't college football season without the delicious ice cold taste of a Dr. Pepper, the one fans deserve. And we got to lead off with Sarah Abbott here, who had an assignment. She understood the assignment and she's ready to unload with her Taylor Swift connection. So, Sarah, take it away.
Yes, this is previewing tonight's game. So I went based off her new album because, you know, it's a banger. It's bops only. So the first song is called The Great War, which has been dedicated to this entire series because, you know, you get it. It's the World Series, like The Great War. And the next song is called Maroon, which I've dedicated to the Phillies. I'm not going to lie to you. This is based on color scheme, which is kind of a maroony color. Dusty Baker, his song is Labyrinth, because Labyrinth is all about love and good things and just a renewed hope, and that is what Dusty Baker represents. Bejeweled, Justin Verlander, because it's all about, like, I'm still here, I'm still sparkling, I'm still bejeweled. That is Justin Verlander. Now this one I'm gonna explain, because it sounds really, really mean, but it's a compliment and I need it on record. It is called Anti-Hero and it's to Bryce Harper, but it's because it's like someone owning their like seemingly bad reputation and really they're kind of the good guy. They're the good guy that everyone roots for in the end. And it was just an evolution of life. And that is what I have so far. More to come.
Nice. Nice work there.
Those are great.
I like that. I think Bryce probably would, you know, love to hear that description.
Yeah. And it's
my guess. What about you, Taylor? Yeah.
Yeah. I think he'd like that. I really like the Verlander one with Bejeweled. Yeah. Great work, Sarah. Very impressed.
Thank you. I forgot the most important one, actually. Mastermind, Rob Thompson. Oh. Also, I Bet You Think About Me. That's not on this album, but that one is dedicated to Miles Teller because that is the music video he starred in.
You know, when you said that, you better think about me. I thought for sure you were going to go, in keeping with our theme, Yordan Alvarez in the lineup. Do you pitch around Alex Bregman?
That's a good one, Buster. Yes, man. I like this. I like this segment a lot.
Coming off the top rope.
Well, you know what? We might have to dig into past Taylor Swift songs as this World Series goes along, that you can apply them to the action that's taking place, right?
That's the big one. That's the spectacular. That one I need a lot of time for because there's a lot to go off of.
Right. You know, if Verlander loses game one of the World Series, he goes into game five and Shake It Off, right? You know,
Buster, are you a Swiftie now, Buster?
I'm not saying a word.
That's not a no.
All right. What are the other Bleacher Tweets, Taylor, before I get myself in trouble?
All right. Well, one more Sarah related. Bob Buscalia writes, and Sarah, if there's a cosmic event, shouldn't that portend an Astros victory? P.S. I stopped at a Runza on Sunday. Sounds delightful. No.
Bob, technically speaking, you are probably correct. However, I'm not NASA, so I'm just going with the cosmic events for the Phillies. Also, I was telling Taylor all about Runza the other day. Ranch, best ranch you'll ever have in your whole entire life. Those gourmet hot pockets, that's basically what a Runza is. Divine. Just a culinary masterpiece.
Okay. Good to know. You're informing the people about Runza. Leggy at the Joe Leg writes in, why do we discount postseason stats when discussing career milestones? These are real Major League Baseball games. Justin Verlander really has 259 wins, 244 regular season, plus 15 postseason. And Albert Pujols has hit 700 career home runs long before the 24th of September.
Yeah, I think the demarcation point has been there, you know, for a long time that, you know, they're not the same, you know, and also if you're on a team that's in the postseason a lot, you have statistical advantage over the other players, which is another reason why they separated. Imagine if you added Derek Jeter's career hits, 3,465 in the regular season, the 200 he had in the postseason, you know, compared to an Ernie Banks who never played in a postseason game. So I get it. It's just a statistical benchmark.
Andrew DeSalvo.
But we do. I'd say this. When we discuss players, we talk about postseason all the time. Like Derek Jeter in the postseason, Mariano Rivera in the postseason, that's a big part of their legacy.
You're right. It is kind of a whole separate conversation. So I think I like that dividing line. Andrew DeSalvo at DeSalvotion writes, and what is the logic for batting Bryce Harper fourth instead of higher in the order? He is the Phillies' best hitter. Wouldn't they want him to want him to bat earlier and more frequently?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because a lot of teams, when you have a player at Harper's level, they tend to bat that guy second. We've seen it with Aaron Judge, you know, Shohei Ohtani, Mike Trout in that two-hole because they want them to get as many plate appearances as possible while giving protection. Maybe it's because the Phillies, you know, have so many guys who command the strike zone. Their priority is to have Harper's presence, get other players' pitches to hit, and that would be JT. You know, maybe that's Hoskins. Maybe it's also if you're Rob Thompson, you're thinking about how to best deploy your left-handed hitters, knowing that you're going to have Schwarber in the leadoff spot. Maybe you want a little bit of a separation between Schwarber and Bryce Harper, so you don't make it easy for the opposing manager, you know, to bring in a lefty for Schwarber and then, you know, pitch to Harper, say two batters later. You split it up by adding a couple right-handed hitters. That would be my guess.
I love that. Tiger Mitch writes in, JT Realmuto is often mentioned as the best catcher, but something I didn't hear mentioned much is his base running. 21 of 22 stolen bases as a catcher is quite impressive.
Yeah, and it jumps out at you when he hits a ground ball, even at, you know, a ground out, how fast he is going down the line. He's got more speed. He's a better athlete than most catchers.
The doll from Bloodborne, a silent flute, our friend who's written him before. After Thompson took over with the Phillies, they went on to hit a 94 wins pace and make the World Series. Looking back at the Girardi replacement, how will history end up explaining what happened in Philadelphia this season? What changed and how?
Yeah, difference making because, you know, according to players, Rob Thompson is very calm. They felt like that he fit better. Look, when Joe Girardi was fired, I was on this podcast saying I thought, you know, this was a case where the Phillies ownership, leadership basically scapegoated Girardi and it was the wrong move. And clearly I was wrong, right? Because the way they've played since then, it's been dramatic in terms of the turnaround. There's no getting around that. Probably the most impactful mid-season managerial change since Bob Lemon took over from Billy Martin in the midst of the 1978 season and took the Yankees to win the World Series.
Wow, Buster, I love your honesty there. I really appreciate that. That's what you get on the Baseball Tonight podcast. We got one more tweet. Carlos Munoz at Carlos Almighty. What are the chances that the Mets or any other team in the offseason take Trey Turner and use him to play center field, replacing Nimmo again like he did in the past?
Yeah, Carlos, I don't think that in 2023, Trey Turner is going to play a position other than shortstop. If someone, you know, signs him, pays him a lot of money, they're going to have him at shortstop for next year. But I would say this. As you look at him for a guy that, you know, you're going to potentially invest a 7, 8, 9 year deal in, you're feeling good about how he's going to transition as he gets older because he can play other positions. He's already played the outfield in his career. He's already played second base. So, you know, after you get, say, 4 years from him at shortstop, you know, maybe he becomes a center fielder like a Robin Yount makes that sort of transition. I think it's a good selling point for Turner.
There you have it. Bleacher tweets for Friday. Keep them coming over the weekend as we go through game one and game two of this World Series. Thanks, everyone.
That's it for today. That's it for this week's. My thanks to Sarah, to AJ Hinch, to Steve Sparks, to Rabbi, to Hembo, to Sarah Abbott, Taylor Schwenk. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something that we need to fight against every single day.